and what to do.
Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Streaming live around the planet via the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, as well as broadcasting on WPRN-FM in New Orleans. Additionally, you can listen to the show on your cell phone by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the station ID code 2899. I'm Frank Warren, editor and publisher of the UFO Chronicles, returning as your guest host tonight while Angela is enjoying some time off with her family on this holiday weekend. For the latest in UFO news, both past and present, you can find us at the UFO Chronicles at www.ufochronicles.com. Normally at this time, when I host the show, I like to give a shout-out to our listeners in the Big Easy. However, tonight I wish to expand that out to all the residents of the great state of Louisiana, as well as the other Gulf Coast states affected by this horrendous, unprecedented, preventable catastrophe that some refer to as just an oil spill. As we begin this holiday weekend in celebration of our independence and the birth of our country, I know I'm in good company when I say that our thoughts and prayers go first to those that lost their lives, followed by all who have been agonized by this ongoing devastation, and for those that will be. Now back to tonight's show. On a more positive note, one of the things unique to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on the internet side is the fact that not only can you listen to the show, but you can participate in conversation in real time using the software known as PalTalk. I like to call it our virtual auditorium, or V-Room, if you will. The software in question downloads in minutes, is relatively easy to use, and enables you to posit questions to either myself or my guests. You can, if you currently don't have PalTalk and you'd like to give it a try, you can Google it, or better yet, go to the UFO Chronicles, which again is at www.theufochronicles.com. And at the bottom of the article for tonight's show, you'll see the links to a step-by-step procedure for how to download the software and navigate to this room for this specific episode. In taking a peek in the V-Room, it looks like we've got another good crowd, and I know many of you are eager to ask our guests some questions, and as usual, I'd ask that you hold off a bit, at least until we get into the show a ways, and you'll know when. In recognition of the 63rd anniversary of the UFO crash in New Mexico and the corresponding festival taking place this weekend, which has made the town of Roswell famous, we have two very special guests on hand who will be coming to us live from the festivities there. My first guest tonight is a perfect fit given the timing of this 4th of July holiday as well as the anniversary of the Roswell event. Like his father before him, Jesse Marcel Jr. is a true patriot. No one could have predicted that after joining the Navy in 1962, 42 years later, he would be fighting in the Iraq War at the youthful age of 68. Jesse, in 2004, was called back to active duty. He flew over 225 hours as a flight surgeon for the 189th Attack Helicopter Battalion. He retired again as a full bird colonel. Along with Jesse's many accolades, he has added author to the list. In 2007, after I wrote a review for his book, The Roswell Legacy, he explained to me that he had desired to write the book for some time, wanting to set the record straight in regards to not only his involvement and perception of what took place on the Foster Ranch in the summer of 47, but more importantly, to give his voice to his father and the actual facts as they happened. Being reminded of his mortality while in combat in Iraq, the book would soon come to fruition. Anyone who has read my review knows that Jesse's book didn't disappoint, and I highly recommend it. Jesse details his experience not only as the son of the first military officer present at the 1947 crash site, but as a witness and handler himself to some of the crash debris. He completes the tome by sharing his involvement in the research up to present day and how the Roswell incident has affected his life and that of his family. It's truly a great honor for me to welcome to the Joyner Report, live from Roswell, Dr. Jesse Marcel. Jesse, welcome.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
You know, Jesse, first and foremost, what I would like to do on behalf of our listeners and all Americans on this 4th of July weekend is thank you for your service to this country. I think it's a safe thing to say that you are the epitome of going the extra mile, to put it mildly.
Well, I've kind of been there and done that.
It's been quite a lot.
It
certainly has, and I do have one regret that I think it was in 2007, I believe, where you and I were to speak together in Aztec, and I couldn't make it at the last minute, and I called in good friend and colleague Mike Fortson to substitute for me, and he gladly did it on short notice, and he, like me, was just so proud to be able to shake your hand. And he took my place. And if I have one big regret in not attending that particular event, it was not to shake your hand myself and to meet you personally. But in any event, I'm glad you're on tonight. And why don't we just begin this thing? You're there in Roswell as the festivities begin. Why don't you just give our listeners a feel of what's going on today?
Well, in Roswell itself, it's a big 4th of July festival, and it's centered around the Roswell event, UFO crash on the Foster Ranch here. So this has really put Roswell on the map, and it's great for the Chamber of Commerce. But there's been a lot of serious studies with this too, because we have investigators giving their addresses and their findings, and it's never ending investigation, and there's a lot of people here contributing to this.
Did everything started yesterday, didn't, or was it today?
It was yesterday. I kind of got in late yesterday afternoon for the beginning of this thing, so I missed part of it.
Now, are you a speaker this year there? Or?
Yeah, I spoke a little bit this morning, primarily in the award ceremony. So Stanton Friedman and Dave was entered to the award ceremony. So, for this thing, my voice is not very good, as you know, but anyway, it was primarily for the award ceremonies for Stanton Friedman.
And how are the crowds this year?
Well, fair enough. It's pretty crowded here. Very popular.
I wish I was there with you, I'll have to say. I know you've told this story 1,000 times, and given the fact that it's the 63rd anniversary of the event, if you would you mind beginning how this actually started for you and take us back to that night in the summer of 47 when your dad came and woke you up?
At the beginning, as everybody knows, my dad was the intelligence officer for the 509 composite bomb crew. And apparently something had crashed on the Foster Ranch about 75 miles northwest of Roswell. And the rancher picked up some debris and brought it into the town where the sheriff's county officer saw this, and he referred it back to Colonel Blanchard at the air base. And since my dad was the intelligence officer, Colonel Blanchard, who was the base commander, sent my dad and a CIC agent out to the field. Sheridan Cavett was the CIC agent. So both he and my dad drove out to the Foster Ranch, and they saw this big field of debris. My dad described it as being very large, maybe half mile, three quarters of a mile wide, just metal debris and unknown material there. So what he did, he picked up representative sections of this thing, samples of this, and as did Sheridan Cavett. My dad was in his pirate car, a 1942 Buick Special, and since our house was on the way to the airbase, as he was driving in, he swung by the house to show my mother and myself what this looked like. You know, it's about 1 o'clock in the morning, but he had pre-positioned some material on the floor of the kitchen, and he woke my mother and myself up so we could look at this strange stuff that he brought in from the Foster Ranch. So he woke me up. I walked in the kitchen. My mother was already up, and I was looking at this junk on the kitchen floor. I thought, what the heck is he doing? waking me up at 1 o'clock in the morning just to look at a bunch of junk here. And he said, look closely at this. He's very excited. He said, I think this is part, and I think he used the word flying saucer. But I won't, you know, take that to the bank, but at least admit that. So he said, you know, look at this.
Jesse, yeah. Can I pause you just for a second? In his excitement, did you could you reference a time when he was that excited before? I mean, could you did that? He wakes you up in the middle of the night. I mean, I'm imagining this in my mind's eye. You're mm-hmm. asleep. He's excited. Had you seen him that way before? Was he a person that would get excited like that? I mean, what? I mean, obviously, this had to strike you that. You know, what's going on? He's waking me up in the middle of the night.
That's what really cued me into this thing, because I'd never seen my dad like that. He was not a guy that really took, you know, things excited and blowed up out of proportion. So I'd never seen him like this. And he said, you know, this is part of a flying saucer. And at that time, I wasn't quite sure what a flying saucer was. But it was his excitement that really drove my curiosity. And he said, the first thing I want you to do, Jesse, is to look at the debris. See if you can find any electronic components like vacuum tubes, resistors, or condensers or wires. And of course there wasn't any. But he already knew that, but he wanted me to satisfy myself on this. And my mother was in the corner of the kitchen kind of looking over all this. So what I did, I saw this all this foil, very strange like stuff. And I picked it up and, you know, you'd be confused with the aluminum, you know, wrap of kitchen wrap, but it was a little heftier than that. I did not try to bend it or tear it or stress it in any way, shape, or form, but I realized this was different than aluminum foil. Mm-hmm. And my mother, you know, saw the same thing. So that really piqued my curiosity, and I realized at that time this was not any, this is very unique. This is not anything I'd ever seen before, nor since.
How much quantity was there? Did he put everything he brought into the house on the table all at once?
No. This was on the kitchen floor, mind you.
The kitchen floor
was about 8 by 15 feet in area, and most of the floor area was covered by this debris. And there's some boxes left in the car that he did not even bring in.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say that the strange thing was not the foil, but there's some beams or rods there that had some very unique lettering along the inner surface of this. The ones I saw were about 12 to 18 inches long. I don't remember if the ends were fractured or were they cleanly cut, but the lettering of the writing was very, very strange. I at first thought this was like a hieroglyphic, but it wasn't really hieroglyphics either. It was like geometric symbols of various kinds, like truncated pyramids, oblate spheroids, things along that line. Various combinations of this.
Over the years, haven't replicas been made of those beams based on your memory?
They sure have. Uh-huh. And, people ask, you know, how can you remember this from so many years? But I tell you what, when you see something like that, it really, you know, your mind is like a sponge at that time. Just soaks up all the information that you have there. You know, and it's so unique looking at it. You know, the color was different. You know, it was like a purple-violet hue, semi-reflective of light. And, it was a gee whiz thing.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 11 years old.
11 years old, okay. And about how long do you feel did you have the opportunity to inspect it?
About 15 or 20 minutes. You know, and, my dad says, you know, I have to get back to the airbase. So we loaded it back into the car, and that's when I noticed there were packages or boxes of material that he did not bring in. So I knew there was more than just
that. You helped him carry the debris back out to the car and then witnessed the additional. They were cardboard boxes full of debris, but what were the sizes of the boxes that were left in the car?
Oh, they're like packing boxes, 1 or 2 cubic feet in volume.
Uh-huh. And your dad, of course, was by himself at that point. He didn't have Cabot with him.
No, Cabot went on to the basement in the carryall in the military vehicle.
And to the best of your knowledge, the bulk of the debris was in the carryall.
I don't know. I really don't know, but I would imagine so. But I know there was a lot of it left out there. Because they went out, you know, according to what I know, they sent teams out there to collect the remainder of the debris.
So he then leaves. Now, about the entire time, from the time that he woke you up and you had the time to inspect the debris, what length of time are we talking about?
Oh, maybe 45 minutes to an hour. Not very long at all, but, you know, early in the morning, they're pretty sleepy.
Do you recall what time? Was it 1, 2 o'clock?
You know, it was summertime. I had been playing hard that day, and I do know that it was very late in the evening, very early in the morning. I do not know what time it was. I do not look at the clock. But it had to be in the early hours or late hours of the evening. Early hours of the morning or late hours of that evening.
Now you said that you weren't... You don't recall exactly if he used the term flying saucer, but you think maybe he did?
That was the indication I got. I later started reading about flying saucers in the newspapers, and I thought, well, this is what he's talking about.
And had you heard, of course, we now know that the news broke on the 8th, I believe, which was a Tuesday. Now, do you recall what the date was on the day that he brought that home? That was over the weekend, was it not?
Yeah, goodness knows. You know, summertime, I was out of school, having fun playing with my friends, Gale Sully, riding our bicycles all over the place. So days did not mean anything.
Right. I believe that was over the weekend.
Yeah, very well, Jim.
Now, prior to that, of course, the news of flying saucers was starting to permeate newspapers across the country in the tail end of June and in the beginning part of July. So up until that point, you really hadn't been paying attention to the news. You yourself, you don't recall hearing anything about the flying saucers going across the country?
No. You know, like I said, it's summertime, so I was having fun.
Right. You were doing kid stuff, sure. But exactly. So it didn't pique your interest until you saw that debris and saw your father's interest in it, obviously.
Yeah. His excitement and the uniqueness of the debris itself, you know, really piqued my attention. That's the reason I really paid close attention to what I was looking at.
So he leaves, then what happened? Did you go back to bed? Did you stay up?
Yeah, no, I went back to bed and just still kind of wondering what this stuff was, and you know, my mother went back to bed. I'm not sure whether he went into the base that night or early the next morning, but the next day when I got up, he was gone. And apparently, it's my understanding that he had gone into the base, showed this debris to Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, who then assigned my dad to fly this into Fort Worth to the Roswell Army Airfield, and there, where General Blanchard was, the base commander. Mm-hmm. And apparently, from what I've read, he flew this under armed guard in a B-29.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how did your mother react to the debris as you were inspecting it with your father?
Well, you know, that's a good question. A lot of people ask that. But, you know, she is a housewife from the 1940s, a military lady who kind of kept things to herself. She kind of looked at it. And I'm sure she had a lot of questions herself, but she was not, you know, I guess excited about as I was, but she was there. And but you know, housewives in the 1940s kind of kept themselves.
Sure.
They did not display a whole lot of emotions.
Different time, different era. I understand completely.
Exactly.
Although some of our younger listeners may not, but I completely understand. Well, I just, you know, as long as I've been personally involved in Roswell research, and by the way, for our listeners' information, you and I, before we went on the air, I was explaining to you that a FOIA had come in, a FOIA request, mm-hmm. that we got some of the Ramey records today along with DeBose and Ramey's personal aide and pilot, Showalter. I haven't even looked at anything yet. And of course, our goal—I don't want to get too far off point here—but just to put this 2 cents in. We are in the process of trying to ascertain whether or not Ramey did make the trip back to Roswell, as was indicated in what I call the Schmidt affidavit, not the Hot affidavit. Since Schmidt admitted on another radio program that he basically took snippets of what Walter said over the years and wrote the affidavit himself. But in any event, we are actively looking into the fact, you know, of course, if Ramey went back to Roswell, and we have no evidence of that yet, that is big, obviously. But we are looking into that, and I just thought I would throw that in. Well, now, so the next day you didn't see your dad. When was the next time that you saw him?
You know, I'm not sure how much time intervened there, but he was gone a day or two, and this is when he was in at Fort Worth with General Ramey, and you know, I finally flew back to Roswell, and.
For the times, I mean, back in those days, the you know, when a military officer or personnel, when they were told to do something, they did it. If they were told to keep their mouth shut, they did it. The sense of duty and just being true blue, it was a different time back then.
A lot of
people aren't aware of that. Yeah,
it was totally different outlook at that time.
Well, you know, it's so exciting to relive those events of that time, and literally for you to have that in your hands. And then of course as the summer goes on, and then the flying saucer activity gets publicized. What did you think? Of course, the West Coast had got the breaking story that Roswell Army Airfield had a flying saucer in their possession, and then later, within 24 hours, quite frankly, the other part of the country is getting the debunking story from Ramey about the weather balloon. How did you feel about that at that point when you first heard about that?
Well, I knew the story had spread not only nationwide, but worldwide, because my dad even got a call from somebody in China asking about this.
As did the sheriff's office, yeah.
Yeah, and so he got calls from all over the world. Well, China for sure, because I remember that one. but others I'm also certain about.
But I mean, what was your, you know, you went from one night to having the debris in your hand, your father's excited, the next time you see him, he swears you to secrecy, but then at that point the news is getting out about the balloon debunking story. And how did you feel about that? You actually had the debris in your hand, and now,
Well, you know, I knew that was absolutely wrong. You know, it was not a balloon that I saw, for heaven's sakes. It was not, corner reflector from a radar target, because even at that age, I knew what radar targets were. And this was not that.
There's something I want to get into a little bit later in the book about your father's experience and training with radar that I feel is very important, and I'm certainly glad that you added it to the book. But even your perception and your knowledge as an 11-year-old boy about radar targets, I mean, even you were familiar with them.
Oh, yeah. You know, balloons and things like – my dad brought some balloons home. You know, for me to play with, you know, the weather balloon type things.
Right.
But, you know, obviously this is not that, you know, just give me a break.
Well, and important to note that the ranchers obviously were aware of that type of thing because they were worried about the livestock eating neoprene balloons and weather balloons and that sort of thing. So it was easy to identify for the ranchers because it was a hindrance to the livestock.
Yeah. Yeah, he knew it wasn't a balloon, a weather balloon, because he picked up weather balloons before, according to his testimony.
Right.
And but this was not that, of course.
And so even then, when this story's going around, it's safe to say that the people of Roswell and folks that were hip to what was going on weren't buying what they were selling.
Oh yeah, I'm sure of that. You know, I was out of the loop by that time, so. You know, the story to me was killed, was dropped. I just, you know, kept it to myself. But the people in the know, of course, did the same thing. You know, the military, you know, always wanted to keep this a secret. And since I was ordered not to talk about that, I just let it drop. But it was always in the back of my mind.
Right. As the days that followed the event, did the story just die down? I mean, did it just go away, or what happened? Did people continue
to talk
about it?
As far as I know, you know, with my friends, because I was not in contact with adults at that time. My friends, I had several friends I played with, and we never discussed it. As far as the people in town, I didn't really pay any attention to what was going on in town. But I suspect that, you know, the Roswell paper, he killed a story the next day. Walter Hunt put out a article just to say the saucer story was emptied.
Right, right.
And it sure was.
Which of course came from Ramey. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did your dad seem to you in the weeks and months that followed after that?
You know, it didn't seem to bother him because he was a good soldier and he believed in following orders to the letter.
Mm-hmm.
And if it bothered him, he kept it to himself.
Do you think, in retrospect, that it did bother him at the time?
You know, the only way I can correlate to that is back in 1951, when we were stationed in Washington, D.C., the Korean War was just getting going at that time. And my dad says, you know, I'm getting out of the Army, the Air Force. I've had enough of this. And I said, you know, one of the first times my dad really yelled at me because I said, you can't get out of the Army now because we got the Korean War to worry about. He said, don't you tell me what I can do. Yes, sir. I didn't. But he said, I've had enough of it. So who knows what his feelings were.
And but it sounds like the speculation is that might have been eating at him just a little bit.
It might have been. It might have been all those years.
Yeah. And what about your mom at that point? Did I would assume, given the times, that she let it pass as well, and was
well,
a good
you know,
wife.
Yeah, you know what we did. You know, we'd go to the grocery store and you see the Inquirer or papers like that at that time, talking about, you know, the amazing stories of I was taken to Venus and made love by a Venusian woman or something like that. And that we kind of laughed at that, but we to ourselves, though, we talked about, we really know what's going on out there.
Right.
Let the subject drop.
Right. Well, now, that, of course, was during the 40s and 50s. As an adult, and we're going to get to the book here in a minute, but when do you recall first hearing about Roswell again in more modern times and as an adult?
Okay, you know, Stanton Friedman apparently got wind of this, of the fact that my dad had seen something very special in the, had a UFO sighting in Roswell. And Stanton is the one who really opened the story up at that time, 1978. And by that time, I was out of the Navy. I was living in Hilo, Montana. And that's when I first heard, you know, national news about my dad's experience, because I'd forgotten about it by that time.
But for the benefit of our listeners, Jesse, of course, Stan was going to do a radio show there, I believe, in New Orleans. And they had to take a break, as the story goes. And the DJ had mentioned, he says, well, you know, this flying saucer business, you should go talk to Jesse Marcel Sr. He knows all about it. He handled it back in 47 when he was at Roswell Army Airfield. And, of course, Stan had never heard of your father. And so it began in 1978. And then as Stan always reminds us, this is way before the Internet, and he did some quick detective work and got your dad on the phone. And, of course, Stan, as we know, is the civilian researcher that broke the story. So he got a hold of your dad, and then when did you first hear about Stanton Friedman or the connection from that point, from your perspective?
You know, not until later, much later. Because, like I said, I was out of the Navy, out of the military at that time, and in Helena, Montana. And only then did I realize that from reading reports that my dad had divulged information to Stanton Friedman. Stan Friedman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Stan became a very close friend of my dad. Stan became very close friends with him, and he's part of our family as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm going to take a quick question from the V room, Jesse, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One of our listeners, Rixio, wants to know if you feel that your father made a deliberate decision to come forward. I mean, obviously, the DJ at the radio station knew, so your dad was talking about it. And so the question basically is, did he make a conscious decision to start talking about it, you know, before Stan got involved? Or what's your feeling?
My dad was a radio amateur, very avid ham operator, and apparently he had been discussing or dropping hints to some of his buddies. And this guy in Baton Rouge, I think it was, got wind of this thing, and Stan was there giving a lecture about UFOs, and that's when the radio operator got hold of Stan and said, look, you know, I know somebody who might know a little bit more about this, and it's Jesse Marcel in Houma, Louisiana. So that's when Stan got a hold of my dad.
Right, right. When did you first meet Stan?
Must have been 1980 or thereabouts.
Of course, now
I was back in Houma.
The Unsolved Mysteries show came out in 80, didn't it? Was it 1980?
Yeah, I believe so. Actually, I'm not sure when I first saw Stan. Not sure.
Well, when the Unsolved Mysteries show first broke, that's when things really got hot and heavy. That's when it really got into the public eye, and witnesses started coming forward. And really, that's, we could say, the second wave of the Roswell story, in essence, started,
I
guess we could say. When this thing did break in the 80s, I mean, for you personally and having that experience, I mean, you had the feelings as a young boy at the age of 11. I mean, where was your head at? I mean, did you even care at that point? What were your feelings as an adult as this thing started to grow and the story became public fodder?
Well, as you might expect, since 1947, I realized that there's extraplanetary civilizations, and I saw examples of one of them. So that made me very interested in astronomy and cosmology. So all during that time, I became a very avid amateur astronomer and reading everything I could about cosmology and astronomy at that time. And it just reinforced my belief that, hey, we're not alone. And they're just, I think they're now just beginning to get around to that decision because the Kepler telescope has already found at least 7 Earth-like planets elsewhere. So life is widespread.
I might add that you speak of that, of course, in your book, which I just found absolutely fascinating. There, just so anybody that's read my review of your book knows mm-hmm. that you did not disappoint. It was just it's just a must read, and so much more than a flying saucer or a UFO book. Just a great job, I'll have to say.
Thank you.
And perfect segue into the book. Did you want to add something, Jesse?
I was just going to say it increased my faith in God. Now, that's going to sound strange to people, but I realized then that I always thought about God. I went to a Roman Catholic school here in Roswell, and I always thought that, you know, yes, I know there's a creator out there, but then that really increased my belief in him, in his abilities to create more than just us.
I don't think, ironically, I was talking to another a radio show host earlier in the afternoon who was a retired minister, and he was catching flack for his beliefs. And I thought, you know, look at the duplicity in this thinking. You know, first off, we're literally talking about the greatest ET of all, God.
Yeah.
And
really, yes.
if you do have faith and you do believe that he created all that is around us, all these billions of planets, then to me it's a no-brainer that he could create other life if that's what you believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I don't feel they're not mutually exclusive. I don't see that there has to be a conflict, as some people do feel.
Yeah. You can't limit the creativity of God. Because, like I say, someone once said that if we're all there is, there's an awful lot of wasted space out there.
Well, yeah, he's either omnipotent or he's not. I mean, you can't put a butt in there.
Yeah.
He can create everything,
well, that's right.
But except life on other planets. Come on now, give me a break.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. Yeah, exactly.
Now, you shared with me when the book finally came out, and ironically, you know, Dennis picked up a copy of the book. Dennis picked up, who will be on in the second hour, my copy of the book that you graciously signed for me and mailed it to me. And it's kind of a little irony that we both have you on the show. But when I wrote the review for the book, you shared with me that you had been wanting to do the book for quite some time, and that when you were in Iraq, you were really feeling your mortality, and you thought, I better get this book done. And could you share with our readers, I mean, I know why, and some of it's obvious, but what was your primary motivations for writing the book?
Okay, I want to amplify my dad's credibility. He caught a lot of, after he died, of course, because we didn't talk about him before he died, but, you know, the skeptics know were just taking him to the cleaners, you know, saying like, he didn't know what he knew, and he didn't have the knowledge, and this, but that, the other. So what I wanted to do was to write the book to, you know, explain his credibility. He went to radar school. He's an intelligence officer. He was actually on the faculty of the radar of the Army Air Force Intelligence School. So, you know, this guy was knew what he was doing. He was a handpicked officer of the 509th Bomb Group, the most unique group in the world. So he was who he said he was, and knew what he was talking about. So that's
I, of course, asked the loaded question because I already knew the answer to that. But I have often defended your father, along with many other researchers that are knowledgeable with the Roswell incident, in the sense that the debunkers would have us believe that your father, amongst others, and bear in mind he went out with a CIC officer, along with Colonel Blanchard, could not identify a neoprene balloon in contrast to some exotic debris. The notion is absolutely ludicrous. So when you came out in the book, and by the way, listeners, he puts the credentials, your father's credentials, appear in the book in regards to the radar school that he attended and all the things that he had to pass to graduate the radar school. And, of course, we know his position at Roswell Army Air Field. I mean, let's face it, they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They were responsible for ending, in essence, the Second World War. They were the only nuclear armed air force or air base rather in the world at that time, and we're asked to believe that they couldn't recognize a neoprene balloon. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, that's insane. Obviously, I know myself because I saw it and I know what a balloon looked like, but whatever, just let them believe what they want to, but I know what's the real truth about this.
Well, in the other part of the book, aside from the fact that you inserted so much factual information to support the facts, which of course is impressive all on its own, I felt you really wore your heart on your sleeve in the book, as you know, in regards to the review that I wrote. It was just really, you really opened yourself up in this thing. You wrote how it affected your family over the years. It was just a really heartfelt read as far as I'm concerned. And in that regard, and you can share as much or as little as you'd like, what do you think? I mean, you wrote the book, you were really open about it. You want to touch a little bit on that, how the whole thing has affected your family and your life to that in that sense?
Well, I want it to be as honest as possible. I'm not going to, make a good story better by exaggerating details. I just want to put down, these are the facts, man, these are the facts, like Joe Friday. And again, I started, when I got to Iraq, I realized that, hey, a guy could get killed out here. So I felt, because mortality was all over the place there. So I was not sure I was going to make it home, actually. So I thought I better start writing this now. I still can't. So that's right. What I did. That's the reason, I guess, it was heartfelt, because I thought I better get this thing down on paper.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, as far as family, we kind of kept it to ourselves, because we kind of were Air Force people following orders. The way it affected me was my religious feelings and my interest in astronomy and cosmology. And wow. I think it had an effect on my dad, too, and my mom. But, we kind of kept it to ourselves.
Sure. What about the kids?
My first wife was killed in a car accident. So I remarried and got two more kids. And they were younger at that time. And they're a little bit afraid of the story when they found out. But convinced them that they don't have anything to fear from any extraterrestrials, because they're visitors there. I think they're observers of our civilization to see if we're going to survive our world tendencies. And I think one of the main reasons they have not made a direct contact that we know of is that they probably have more to fear from us than we from them.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that the truth? I thought the other nice touch to the book was Linda's section. That was there. That was just a really nice touch. The book is just such a complete tome, and just I can't say enough good things about it. I read it in one sitting. I couldn't lay it down. I wrote the review as soon as I did set it down. I wrote the review immediately, and I just cannot say enough good things about it.
I appreciate that.
One of the obviously there are just several components in the book that are just absolutely fascinating. But there was in part of the book you describe and write that you were supposed to attend a function in Washington D.C. and I just found this absolutely fascinating, and you know what I'm talking about. Could you explain that scenario to our listeners?
Well, it's strange how it happened, but, I was in practice in my ENT, medicine practice in Hill, when my secretary got a call from some person in Washington, D.C., and he wanted to talk to me. And Linda, my secretary, said, he's busy right now, Can I have him call you later? He said, no. Yeah, I'm so-and-so. I want to talk to him right now. So Linda came and got me and said, you need to talk to this guy because he's an assistant. So I talked with him, and he apparently knew that I was going to be going to Washington to a UFO meeting, I think it was. And he says, when you get here, I want to talk to you. I said, okay. And he said, I'll get in touch with you. And when I got to Washington, when I checked into my motel room, there was a light. The message light was blinking on my phone. And it was a message from him telling me that I was to go to the Capitol building the next day at a certain time.
Now, let me stop you just for a second. As I recall in the book, now, you the whole family was going to go to this event, were they not?
Yeah.
But at the end of it, Linda didn't want to go. She was a little nervous.
No, she's afraid. She's scared.
And she was scared primarily because you felt there was maybe a little hanky-panky going on with the phones, and you were concerned how they knew your itinerary. Is that correct?
Yeah, they knew exactly where it was going to be. So, but anyway, yeah, she did not want to end up at the bottom of the Potomac River. So, I ain't going. But she missed a good meeting. But anyway, yeah, I talked with this gentleman in a secure room in the basement of the Capitol building, and he kind of related that, yeah, this is real. We know it happened. What do you know about this? So I just divulged the content of what I know about this thing.
Well, now, I've got to pause you just again, because I think this is such a when I read that section of the book, and you're ad-libbing a little bit here, but you got the call. I mean, this was something. I'm reading the book, and it's almost as if it's out of a James Bond movie.
It is, really.
The guy, I mean, he gets a hold of you. Now, did he call you? You were at this function that you were with. This was a UFO function that you were attending in Washington?
Yeah, the Prince of Liechtenstein is the one who funded this meeting.
So it was kind of a private affair.
Yeah, it was. And but apparently, you know, this gentleman is in the government. He signed off as being in the CIC or yeah, some top secret NSA, things like that. I don't know whether to believe that or not, but anyway, when he gave me a note to call him if I had any problem, he did sign his name off as NSA, National Security Advisor. But anyway, we went down to the basement of the Capitol building, and he talked about the book. There was a book, actually, Whitney Strieber's book, The Majestic, was on the front of the table there, where
right.
He sat. He said, this is not fiction, meaning Roswell is not fiction. And I thought, you know, of course, the book itself is fiction based on a factual event. But he said, you know, this is not fiction, meaning that Roswell did happen, as already knew it did. And he just wanted to find out what I knew about this.
For the benefit of our listeners, you met this individual, you went to a building in Washington, D.C., you went several mm-hmm. floors down to
the Capitol building, yeah.
Oh, you were at the Capitol building, you went many floors down, and then he took you into what he called a secure room.
Yeah, he first asked me, did I want to talk in a secure room? I said, no, it doesn't make any difference to me because I'm not going to say something I haven't said before, but he said, I might tell you something. So we're going to talk in a secure room. And believe me, there are several floors below the Capitol building where there are these magnificent meeting rooms, mm-hmm. obviously for very important meetings. And we sat to ourselves at this huge table. And as you can imagine, it's a beautiful mahogany building, a room with the picture of the founding fathers on the overhead. And so we discussed this. And he said, he knew that he asked me where I knew the debris was. Did I know where the debris was? I said, no, I don't. Don't you know you're part of the guys there? He said, no, we don't know. We're trying to find it. Mm-hmm. And he conjectured that it was members of the black government. And he said this was a group that have unlimited funds, answered to nobody but themselves. Mm-hmm. And he thinks they are the ones who have this thing. And he called it the black government. So mm-hmm. apparently there
now,
it is.
Now, In an interview that you did in 2007 with Tom Horn, you mentioned the gentleman's name, and I mean it's out in the public domain, so you don't mind I mention it now. I mean, it's all over the place. That individual was Dick D'Amato.
Yeah, he didn't tell me not to talk about this. Now I feel guilty about divulging his name.
Well,
and I guess I don't, people later don't, ask him.
Don't. I don't. Here's what I find interesting, and there's a little bit of an irony in this. Was it him that said that he represented the NSA or was involved with the NSA?
Yes.
Okay, that's one.
Yes, that's a big.
The other, in the interview, which, by the way, is at the UFO Chronicles that you did, Tom Horn allowed us to publish that article. It was a series of articles that he did with various Roswell folk back in 2007, and we were glad to publish that interview with you on site. In that, it is revealed that D'Amato, if I'm pronouncing his name properly, was an aide to recently deceased Senator Robert Byrd.
That's right. I found out about that later. He was trying to investigate where this money was being spent because he felt it was being spent illegally to keep something secret that should not be kept secret.
Did he mention Robert Byrd at all in that meeting?
No, he did not.
Now, given the longevity of Byrd and his stature, and since it appears that D'Amato was, in fact, an aide at one point for Byrd, is it plausible, in your opinion, that Byrd may have been in the know in regards to the events at Roswell?
Oh, I'm sure he was. I'm sure he was.
You know, I actually forgot about the connection to Byrd, but in preparation for tonight's show, I scanned that interview that you did with Tom Horn back in 2007, and I caught that, and I thought, wow, isn't that something? I mean, here we have a standing senator or a sitting senator for over 50 years. I mean, it stands to reason if somebody in the Senate was privy to Roswell, it would be him, obviously.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I still have the yellow legal pad paper that he signed his name on with NSC or NSA on it. My wife kept it someplace, so I still have that page with his telephone number to call if ever I got a threatening phone call.
Did you ever use it?
No.
Isn't that something? How did the meeting end?
Very cordially. You know, he's a nice guy. We're on a first name basis, and it ended like that. So, very nice gentleman.
When you parted company, and we're coming to the end of our hour, Jesse, here shortly. We've got about a minute or so left. What were you thinking? I mean, my God, the guy drops you down to the basement of the Capitol building. You go into a secure room. He basically admits that Roswell took place, although he didn't get into a whole lot of details. I mean, your head had to be spinning.
Well, suspicions confirmed. I was wondering if anybody in the government was ever going to admit to me that, yes, it really did happen. So I felt good at that point, knowing that at least personally somebody took me under their wing and told me all, you know, that this was not fiction, his words.
Right. Wow. The hair on my neck was standing up when I read that part of the book. And a lot of people I think that read the book actually overlooked that. I mean, that is just really exciting stuff. Well, Jesse, as usual, the time just flew by as I knew it would.
Okay.
And I really want to thank you for coming on with such short notice. And real quick, could you just give our listeners your itinerary for this weekend? Are you going to be speaking anywhere else? And how can they find your book?
Well, they can find it on Amazon. You know, I used to sell them out of my website, but I just got to be – that's too much of a hassle. So they can find it on Amazon or other bookstores, things like that. I personally don't sell them, but they can find them at Barnes & Noble, other places. But the rest of my weekend here is just kind of wolfing around. I gave a little talk today. You know, my voice is really suffering from that. I apologize. But
if you wouldn't mind, in the beginning of next week sometime, I sure would like to have a full report of what went on. Just send me an email and give me an update. Well, listen, Jesse, we're completely out of time. I really thank you for coming on.
Okay. Well,
and on that note,
my pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Jesse. In our second hour, we're going to be joined by no other than longtime Roswell investigator and resident and a dear friend of mine, Dennis Ballfaser. You're listening to the Joiner Report on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, WPRN-FM in New Orleans, and we'll be right back.
Okay. My pleasure. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joiner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joiner.
Well, staying in the Roswell theme, my next guest is the second barrel of the proverbial double-barreled shotgun. He is literally a world-renowned Roswell researcher, having appeared on numerous television and radio shows on the subject matter. His award-winning website, TruthSecretRoswell.com, is considered to be one of the best sites concerning the Roswell incident, and its URL is both fitting and descriptive of the efforts of a man I'm proud to both call friend and colleague. Dennis, welcome to the Joiner Report.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
It sounds like before we went on, and the same with Jesse, you guys were pretty busy today. Why don't you share with our listeners what was going on in the beginning days of the festivities out there in Roswell?
Well, it all kicked off yesterday at noon at the City Convention Center for the City Festival. We have two festivals here in Roswell now. The city has one, and the UFO Museum has one, which is hard to explain, but it's the way politics and things operate in a small town here. And it all kicked off yesterday, and then this last night they had the opening ceremonies with the mayor, and Peter Robbins has been involved, the researcher, for several years, and he and the mayor got everything kicked off last night. And then this morning at about 8:15 they started the lectures that ran all day today and up will all day tomorrow. And I had the second lecture at 9:45, which is pretty early in the morning to be doing a presentation, but I made it through it okay and had a good crowd, good audience that early in the morning, which was surprising on a Friday. But things went well, and this afternoon things picked up at the convention center at all the booths that the speakers and the vendors have, and looks like we're going to have a good conference again this year.
So you feel it's right around where it was last year? I mean,
I don't think it's quite as big as it was last year, and I think part of that is due to, the economy for one thing, and the gas prices are pretty high for people to travel, although we had a lot of people come by my table that said they were from our state, a lot from California and Arizona and Missouri. And in fact, I filmed for a little while with a film crew from Australia, mm-hmm. and they came specifically for the Roswell celebration. Mm-hmm. But I think tomorrow will pick up a lot over the weekend, and I think it'll be a good event again. The mayor had gone public a couple of weeks ago, and AP and the Internet picked it up, that he said that they were going to not finance the Roswell Symposium anymore, mainly because he didn't know anything about it. We have a new elected mayor and a new city council, and they just didn't get into the groove of things right away, and he got a lot of flack from that, so he restated his statement a little later and changed his tune a little bit, and we had some cancellations, which was unfortunate because of the publicity we got.
Well, so he had a case of foot-and-mouth disease.
Exactly, yeah. But I think he's been educated a little bit over the last 2 days, so I think things will work out.
I can imagine. Yeah, of course, when he said that, that did go around the world real quick.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it was a negative thing, and we didn't need that. There's enough problems here in town with both festivals going on that we don't need that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
One of the highlights today, and I think Jesse probably mentioned it, was the Hall of Fame inductees last year. Major Marcel was the first one, and this is a city function, and Jesse Jr., his son, accepted the award last year, and Jesse is here again, and this time they put Paul Davids, the movie producer of the Roswell movie in 1994, and Stanton Friedman, were inducted into the Hall of Fame today. I saw Stanton in the hallway, and I walked up behind him, and I said, they'll just put anybody in this Hall of Fame. And he turned around and saw who I was. He said, I guess so. But, you know, Stanton, he can't get up without doing a lecture. Paul Davis got up and said a few words and thanked everybody. Stanton went into a full-fledged lecture for a while when he got up.
Yeah, yeah. An hour later, but mm-hmm. I'm sure the audience was thrilled. Yeah,
you wind Stanton Friedman up, and you're in for a while.
You better believe it. Yeah, Jesse did touch on that a little bit. So, yeah, I think that's just fantastic that his father was acknowledged last year for that. And I really, you know, he's such a patriot. I mean, for God's sakes, he's 68 years old and he's flying helicopters in the war in Iraq. You know, and it just, patriotism just runs in the family.
And I think the military has stopped doing that, Frank. I don't think they allow the flight surgeons to be with helicopters anymore because they've lost several.
Yeah.
So I think they changed their procedures on that too.
Yeah, after the fact. And when I wrote the review for his book, he shared that with me. He says, you know, what really got the book done is, he says, I was really feeling my mortality in Iraq. He says, I didn't know if I was going to make it out of there. And he said, if I make it out of there, I better get this book done.
Yeah, I talked to him at length up at Aztec at a symposium we were both at, and he shared a lot of the information about being over there. And it had an adverse effect on him. He got to fly over some of the places where bodies had been buried by the Iraqis, and it really had an emotional effect on Jesse. I think that had some effect on him.
Well, and as it always does with any man or woman that sees that kind of thing in combat.
But he and his dad both, I consider, really, you know, top-notch military heroes in my book.
And I'm right there with you. I have one, the biggest regret I have, I think it was in 2007. As you know, I was invited to speak in Aztec, and I was unable to make it at the last minute. And I know Mike Fortson is in the V room, and God bless him, good friend Mike Fortson. He stood in for me at the last minute, and he, like you and I, both were just thrilled. He was thrilled to, you know, meet Jesse. Of course, you'd already met him, but he feels the same way, and that he's just a patriot, and he was proud to shake his hand. And that's one of the biggest regrets that I have.
He's an extremely humble man too, and you know.
Oh, you bet.
Being where he is and what he's been through, it's really an amazing situation.
And I had mentioned in the first hour, which I thought a little ironic, that it was you who was kind enough to grab one of Jesse's books the year it came out, have him sign it to me, and then you, of course, mailed it to me and paid for it, I might add. And God bless you for that.
I forgot about that. I did, yeah.
Yeah, I was reading the little writing in there the other day, and from both you signed it, and of course Jesse signed it as well. And I just thought, well, here's a little irony that we have you both on the show tonight. But
well, that signature by me and about a buck and a half will get you coffee anywhere.
Yeah, that $10 will get you a gallon of gas. Huh? Well, that's good. Yeah, it's really something. I'm real glad that you're on the show tonight too. Given I know you have a busy schedule this weekend. You know, given the controversy with the mayor and the city and the museum, and I know you don't want to get into a whole lot of it. We don't have to dwell on it. But I mean, what is the city going to stay behind it? As I feel that they should at this point. I mean, what do you think?
I believe at this point they will, and I agree with the mayor on one thing. He says, I think they spent $150,000 last year to put on the festival, and that's not big money, but in a small town it can amount to a sizable amount. But I think I also saw figures where the lodgers tax from motels and things like that came back at around $800,000. That's a pretty good turnaround on money. And I don't know that he was really aware of that. And I know that everyone from the little T-shirt seller on Main Street up through American Airlines who fly into Roswell are all looking at this, and you know, they're all scrunching numbers around, and I think that I think he'll get behind it, but he does need to look at where they're spending the money. I think there's some things at the festival that are probably not needed, and they might be able to cut back there and replace that with maybe some entertainment of some kind. They've been trying to bring name bands in here and things like that over the years, and that's always a big draw.
But they've been successful at doing that. I mean, you've had big names there almost every year, haven't you?
Yeah. They had cancellations this year. I think one of the big country stars was supposed to come in and cancel when he found out about the mayor's remarks. Mm-hmm. But in the past, we've had Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard and some big rock bands and things like that. As a serious researcher, I don't agree with that, Frank. I'm looking at getting serious people in here to discuss ufology, but I also understand that for the economy, you have to have the what I call woo-woo stuff, which brings in money. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
As for the museum, they have refused, they being the director of the museum, has refused to work with the city for the last 3 years, thus the reason why the city took it over. This started back in about 1992 or 93. A couple guys got together and decided, let's have a festival, a yearly event.
Mm-hmm.
And the museum ran it for several years, and while I was with the museum from 96 to 98 through the 50th anniversary, it was big. I mean, we doubled the population of Roswell during those times for the festival. And then it started going downhill, and the ex-mayor, Sam Legrone, decided that the city should get involved and started doing it and invited the museum to join in, and they refused.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, and this is something probably not public, but something that I want to get out, is the fact that the city committee got together to decide who they would induct in the Hall of Fame. And unanimously, they decided that Walter Haut, who wrote the press release, Lieutenant Haut, when he was 1947 public relations officer, that he would be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter is the director of the museum, and in staying with her, not wanting to agree with anything the city does, she refused it. She would not.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. She refused to accept award for her dad, which tells me that she puts herself before her dad or the Roswell incident. And
that's, for Pete's sake.
That's what we're dealing with here.
Oh, that's just absolutely ridiculous, it seems to me. I don't see rhyme or reason with that at all. Yeah, it's sad. Well, like you, Dennis, you and I have had long conversations about this. I guess Roswell may be an exception to it because it has grown into this to a festival, and it's a double-edged sword. I certainly understand, you know, a city wants to bring the revenues in, and you know, I do understand the festivities behind it. And at this point, we obviously can't go backwards, but certainly, you know, I would like to see a more sober, scientific genre out of it. But, you know, we're way past that. It is a grandiose festival of sorts, and we do have the components of good, sober researchers and presentations and lectures and so forth within that tent.
Well, you know, I live here in Roswell, and it's hard for me as a serious researcher. I hardly can do a radio interview without someone bringing up the UFO Museum, because everybody knows about the UFO Museum being here. And it's hard for me to have the situation that I have, and I don't badmouth the museum and its operation, but I also don't promote it anymore.
Sure.
I know there was times when the National Geographic Channel and the Canadian History Channel came to town and were told that if they film me, they can't film at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
Those type things we don't need. And
yeah,
that doesn't
well,
help
like
the situation at all.
No, not at all. Well, as Mama always said, If you don't have anything good to say, just don't say it at all.
But
but building a wall like that, as what seems to be going on with the city and the museum, is just not productive.
No, it's not good for the city.
Not at all. It's
counterproductive. The community, and it's just nothing work.
Yeah. Well, let's. What I want to do, Dennis, I did this with Jesse, and I don't think it gets talked about enough, but, I mean, you know, most folks have you melded with Roswell, obviously. I mean, you're one of the most well-known researchers about the Roswell incident. You have an award-winning website. People know the name of Dennis Balthaser. As Stan as often says, you are the go-to guy when a researcher goes to Roswell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For God's sakes, would you, for the benefit of our listeners, could you just reiterate how that all began for you, how you ended up in Roswell?
My background is civil engineering. I had 33 years with the Texas Department of Transportation doing civil engineering work and quality assurance and quality control of materials used to build highways and bridges. So, first off, I don't consider myself a woo-woo. I think I have a good background. Prior to that, I had 3 years in the United States Army at Fort Bliss, Texas, was assigned to Greenland twice by the Army, which I never forgave them for. And so I had 36 years total in engineering. When I retired in 1996, I was 54 years old, single, and sent resumes all over the country to different manufacturers and steel companies and things that I had worked with. So I sent out resumes expecting to continue my engineering work.
Mm-hmm.
As it would happen, an engineering firm here in Roswell, Smith Engineering, asked me to come up to do an interview. And I came up, and of course, I've had the interest in UFOs for 20, 25, 30 years, I guess, as a hobby. And I came to Roswell, I went to the museum, I did the resume, and I was hired by this engineering company. Well, shortly after I moved up here in 96, I started going by the museum and started volunteering my time there on weekends. And next thing you know, I was doing lunch hours going into the museum. And after work, I was going in, picking up correspondence and communicating with people and things like that. And after 6 months, I decided that that's what I wanted to do. So I gave up a good paying job with an engineering company and started volunteering full time at the museum 70 hours a week. I was there 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. I was unofficially the UFO investigator. There are no titles there for volunteers. And I was on the board of directors for a year. And then I started having problems because of the interception. I was getting a lot of publicity because of the interception that I went through that you helped me with.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Oklahoma to try to get a piece of metal. And shortly after that, I was asked to sever my relationship, and I was given my $1,000 lifetime membership back. And I've not been in the museum in about 7 years, and I tell people I've been thrown out of better places.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know you don't want to dwell on that, but could you just run a quick synopsis from your perception as to what took place? I mean, are we talking about just personality conflicts? What do you think? I mean,
I know, knowing
you personally and knowing some of the intimate details of it, I shake my head.
I don't really seriously know what their motive was for asking me to leave, but as it turned out, it was a benefit to me because I began doing the research as an independent researcher, working with you and with Stanton Friedman, Scott Ramsey, and David Rudiak, and a few others. And I have limited myself to the researchers that I work with because this whole field of ufology is full of people that really don't do research. Like Stanton says, they're secondhand armchair researchers.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, there's 2,000 websites on Roswell. And luckily, I've been told that I have one of the top 10 sites, but that's because I try to do serious research. Most of the people that you read about or see on the Internet that do research on Roswell have never been here. They've never interviewed a witness or met a witness. They've never been to the crash sites. And you've got to get out and get your feet and hands dirty to do this type work. So I think it was a benefit to me to get away from the museum and do it as an independent.
A blessing in disguise. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
When you mentioned the interception, and I personally believe, and we don't need to spend a lot of time on it and try to condense it down, but that kind of happened early on while you were at the museum. Why don't you do a quick synopsis of that? And I really, we'll get to, at the end of it. I mean, to me, the value of the interception is still very high. And as you know, you, at one point you weren't going to do the lecture anymore, and I talked you back into it. And
yeah.
I really feel it's important that you do it. But could you explain that to our listeners, please?
Yeah, before I do that, today when I did my Roswell Then and Now lecture today, which is a history of who was stationed at the base, the crash sites, where they're located, just mostly factual information about the Roswell incident, what we know. And at the end of it, I mentioned the interception again. I briefly go over it. And when I got through the questions and answers session, that's where I got questions about the interception. So, there still is a lot of interest in it, which I didn't realize there would be. But thanks to you, this is good research. We spent 12 years doing this research to get a finalization on it. And after 12 years of perseverance and teamwork and working together and pursuing this, we got an end result. Not the result that we expected, I don't think, but we did get an end result.
Dennis, then let me pause you. You're doing what Jesse did. I got Jesse to explain the experience that he had with Dick D'Amato, who initially wasn't named, when he was brought down into the entrails of the Capitol building down in the dark deep dungeon, which was almost like chapters out of a James Bond book, but it was something that literally happened. With you on the same basis, let's don't leave out some of the juicy parts. Although the end result wasn't something that we would have liked, it was the benefit of good research. But explain to the listeners how it began. You get a phone call one day.
At the museum, we got a call from Oklahoma from a guy who said his dad was stationed here as a military policeman and had a piece of a medal, which the son that called said he had never known about or knew about Roswell, in fact. So I had several phone calls with the son trying to set up something to go to Oklahoma, hopefully to videotape or cassette tape the father, get him on tape, get the story, get the medal, bring it back, and have it tested. Because he told his son that people would kill over that. So I made arrangements to go to Oklahoma. Confidentiality was high. They wanted confidentiality. I guaranteed that. And I told everyone at the museum that I was going to see my son who attended college in the same town in Oklahoma, which was a good cover for me, a good excuse. So I went to Oklahoma, had a phone number, checked into a hotel and called the number I had. And was told the guy was out of town on an emergency.
Now, Dennis, let me pause you right there, just for the benefit of our listeners, to condense what you just said. You got a call to the museum, and if I remember correctly, he was actually, what was said was that they were trying to reach Roswell Army Airfield, the old air base, whatever took its place.
And somehow the operator referred him to the museum, and that's how we got involved.
That's how it got started. And he tells you his father was stationed at Roswell, and literally he has in his possession what we've all been looking for, the smoking gun, a piece of the Roswell memory medal, for lack of a better term, or whether it was the memory medal or not, I don't know if he got that far, but he actually had a piece of the Roswell material.
He described it as the memory medal. He said it's
as the memory medal. Okay.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're jumping, you're doing double back flips at this point.
Yep. It's a roller coaster. Kind of like a roller coaster. Going over there, I was high. Coming back, I was low. But anyway, I got over there and couldn't make contact because he was out of town. So I laid around the hotel the next day, called three times, kept getting a recording, and was starting to think that maybe it was a hoax. The son had told me that he was an attorney. I checked the phone book. There was no listing under that name, and there was no attorney listed under that name. So I laid around the hotel, tried three times, kept getting a recording, and finally I got a call about 3 o'clock saying, meet him at Denny's restaurant at 7 o'clock. So I went to Denny's restaurant, a man and woman came in with the closing description they had given me. He looked at me and said, are you Dennis? I said, yes. He said, the gentleman you plan on meeting will not be here. I said, who are you? He said, we're special agents of the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation. I said, how'd you know I was coming over here? Is my phone tapped? He said, we knew Friday you would come in here Monday. On Monday, you'd be here Friday. And he said, you know how we do business. I spent 3.5 hours with him. He had a map of New Mexico. We talked about the crash sites. He had some drawings of UFOs. We talked about Area 51. We talked about the government cover-up. We covered the whole base for 3.5 hours. I left the meeting realizing that I didn't see or get to meet the gentleman I had planned on meeting. I drove back to Roswell. I made another few phone calls back to Oklahoma over a 5-month period. And each time I called over there, another voice would come on the phone and basically tell me in no uncertain terms that they didn't do any strong-arm tactics. And then finally, 6 months later, I realized I had never checked who owned the phone. So I called the long-distance carrier I have, asked them to check on the name of a number in Oklahoma, and it turned out to be the first name of the female agent. It was a male and female. And I called over there and told her who I was and that I was very unhappy with the way things had transpired. And another voice came on the phone and said, if you keep messing with the Air Force OSI office, you're barking up the wrong alley. Click. That was the last conversation I had. And then you and I started doing some more work on it, and eventually we discovered that the woman agent was the ex-wife of the guy that I was meeting with, and that he had done this to other people, and it turned out it was a scam or a hoax. So it took 12 years to do it, but with your help and a couple others, we finally got a finalization to it. But every time I do this lecture now, and I hadn't done it since 2002, I did it up at Angel Fire 2 weeks ago, and it was received well. I did it part of it today, and it was received well. And the interest is still there, but most comments that I get is that they think that there was still something to it. Mm-hmm. And one guy up at Angel Fire said, this would make one hell of a movie. And I thought to myself, it probably would, but I said, I don't know that we're going to go that route. But well, it was an experience. I was paranoid for about 5 days when I came home.
Oh, sure. Listen, when you brought me into it, I was too, believe me, as you know. what I feel is important about that case, regardless of the outcome, A, these things happen. There are hoaxes out there. This goes on.
Right.
B, the being the researchers that we are, we followed this to the end, and it obviously was not the outcome that we had desired, but we investigated it and then made the results public. Now, I know at one point you did not want to, you didn't feel that it was worthy to lecture on that anymore. And as you recall, I said, why? I really do feel it is important to lecture. The events happened exactly as you described them. Mm-hmm. And together, we did some good research and got to the bottom of it.
Yeah, the lecture runs. It runs a little over an hour, and it's nearly all a verbal lecture. There's no pictures. I don't use pictures on it because I don't have anything related to it.
Right.
But it's intense because I noticed that with the audience, that the attention from the audience is unbelievable.
Sure.
And that's because I give about a minute by minute description. I have the telephone tapes that the phone calls I made. I quote all the conversations that took place, both on the telephone and in person over there. I have learned from this, and if I ever get the opportunity again to look for a piece of metal or get a witness or something like that, two things will happen. I will either have help with me, not do it alone, or I'll have a certain caliber on me. Because when I came back, I talked to intelligence people, and they told me, had you got the medal, you would have never got back to Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And that was uncomfortable, but that was probably a reality and a good statement. But I've learned from it, and now I'm what I'm finding, Frank, is that it's still emotional.
Yeah.
When I do the lecture now, I'm still emotional at points because it really had an effect on me at the time. I lost 15 pounds in 3 months. I put tape over the hood of the truck, hood and fender of the truck, an old police trick, and I checked every morning if the tape was broken. I wasn't going to start the engine.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were certain things that took place during that period of time that probably have a lifetime effect on me.
I remember it well. And,
yeah, you would.
And I was very cautious myself as I entered into that fray.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I you know, as you can tell by the audience, it's the regardless of the outcome, the lecture is well received, and I'm quite frankly, I'm thankful that you're doing it. I really think the story needs to be told. You know, everybody wants to hear all the good sides to ufology. Well, there are people that do, you know, that perpetrate hoaxes. And
this is some of the things you go through to do this research. And at the time, I wasn't aware of it. Of course, I was new to it, you know, and wasn't prepared for what happened when they said the gentleman you plan on meeting won't be here. I knew I was at the wrong place at the wrong time for some reason.
Right. Well, moving on. One of the things, I shared this a little bit in the first hour, and we've talked about it briefly in our second hour. Of course, I call it the Schmidt affidavit, but it came out in the so-called hot affidavit that Walter, in fact, saw Ramey in Roswell shortly after the Roswell event, and you know, during that time period, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the 6th, 7th, or 8th,
mm-hmm.
And that he had a meeting out there. Now,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that Schmidt did, and it's at the UFOChronicles.com because I did the transcript, he was on another show where he basically stated that he had culled snippets of information from Walter over the years and had compiled them together and basically put that in written form, and then Walter signed it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all know that Walter was suffering from dementia in his later years, and of course the question comes up, you know, was he confused? Did that in fact happen or whatnot? Now, obviously, if General Ramey, if we can put Ramey in Roswell in the first part of July for the meeting, if in fact he flew back from Fort Worth to Roswell, that is big stuff.
Yeah.
Now,
and
you and I and Stan are working on that, and I did receive some FOIA information on Ramey DeBose and Ramey's personal aide and pilot, Showalter, today. Haven't
mm-hmm.
even looked at it yet. But you'll be getting some information here shortly within in the next day or two, along with Stan.
There's a situation here on this, and Walter Hart, when Wendy Connors and I did the oral history on him, which we were told by his daughter, the director of the museum, that we could never use it or any conversations we ever had with him after they had approved us doing it. If, in fact, Ramey was in Roswell for a meeting, I believe the morning of July 8th, the same day.
That was a Tuesday.
Same day the press release went out.
Mm-hmm.
If he was here, my question is, why did Major Marcel go to Fort Worth with the material if Ramey was here and already seen it? Unless that was part of the cover-up. He would mm-hmm. take it to General Ramey in Fort Worth. They'd take pictures by James Bond Johnson and put the weather balloon on the floor. And those pictures that were taken by James Bond Johnson, there is a piece of paper underneath the weather balloon that's laying on the floor. And I have discovered that if you look at that piece of paper, that paper came off of a new roll.
It did.
That paper has nothing ever been wrapped in it, which would indicate that it was shipped from Roswell to Fort Worth. And behind General Ramey and Colonel DeBose, in that one of them pictures, is an unopened package, which is probably the package that Marcel took to Fort Worth. So I think this is real critical on getting information on whether he was here or not. And if he was here, and Walter said he was here. Walter said they had a meeting at the base and mentioned a few of the people that were there when we did the interview. So this is critical information. And, you know, the photograph of Ramey Holt and the teletype is one thing that's got information of it that can't be denied. If this can prove that he was in Roswell for the meeting, that's really big.
It is. It's huge. And, of course, we are actively researching that notion. I personally don't feel that Ramey, in fact, was there. I think that Walter was confused towards the end. I don't know if he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's or whatnot, but it was clear that he had some form of dementia.
Well, and we had when Wendy and I did the interview with him, he had a problem remembering where he took basic training. He had a problem remembering names. And Wendy finally pressured him to where he admitted that he had seen a body in the hangar under a tarp. He saw part of the body under a tarp from a distance of 25 or 30 feet away, which he had never really gone public with before. He's had three affidavits. He had one that was signed by a witness by Max Littell, another co-founder of the museum years ago, the oral history that Wendy Connors and I did, and then the one that Don Schmidt wrote. The one that Don Schmidt wrote, Schmidt did not witness him signing that. He wasn't in town. They brought in someone from the museum floor, a visitor to the museum, as a witness. We don't know the last name of that person, so we can't verify that. And whether or not Hawk actually agreed to what was written, I don't know. But he did not write it. Schmidt has admitted that he wrote the affidavit.
In verbatim. And I actually have that transcript that he admitted that on air on another radio program.
And
I transcribed it.
Schmidt waited to put that out until the Roswell Festival that year in a book,
came.
He was looking for publicity on top of it.
Yeah, well, and he certainly did get that. I don't, and let's be clear, no disrespect to Walter Haught.
No.
I feel the same about him as I do Jesse Marcel Jr. and Sr. The man was a patriot, a great man, as everybody would testify that knew him, and there's no disrespect to him at all. This is just an observation in regards to the dementia and what was going on in his later years. I mean, it would be mind-boggling if, in fact, we could prove that Ramey, in fact, was there. So far, no evidence has surfaced at all to indicate that. But
I agree with you. I had the highest respect for Walter because when I was at the museum for those 2.5 years, I saw Walter every day. We talked every day. I'd go in his office, and we'd sit there and talk about his personal life. We'd talk about the weather. We talked about the incident. And his story never changed. He said all he did was write the public relations. He was a public relations officer and wrote the article under orders of Colonel Blanchard.
Right.
Him and Blanchard were very close. He considered him the old man and had a lot of respect for him. He said if he called me and said, I need you in my office, he said, I was there. And we had a lot of conversations over the years, and I had the utmost respect for him. And I do believe that he was involved. I think he may have gone over to the hangar and seen the body, like he finally said, but we don't know. We may never know.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the one of the other things that I'm often asked, and I know you are too, many people feel that we're beating a dead horse. Now, I have my answer for that, but what do you think in regards to Roswell?
Well, we've been given four excuses by the Air Force, and my personal theory on the Roswell incident, and this is something I've thought for several years, is that whatever we recovered, and you have to keep in mind that we recovered debris, not a full craft. We recovered pieces of a craft. I don't think that our military or our government knows 63 years later what they have. In other words, the propulsion system, the guidance system, the motive of coming here, where they came from, and things like that. And until the military gets the technical advantage out of that craft for their own use, I don't think the military or the government will admit it happened or know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because to have that type technology would be a tremendous advantage over our adversaries, and I think for that reason they will continue to deny any knowledge of it until they get the technology out of it.
In my view, and I've said this time and time again, one of the things that continues to go on with Roswell, although it has slowed up, witnesses continue to surface. And I was asked the other day, point blank, don't you think you're beating a dead horse with Roswell? And my answer is, point blank, no. Because as long as, until it is completely solved and we know exactly what's going on, then there's still work to be done. That's number one. Number two, we still get new witnesses or families, members of witnesses or collateral witnesses that come up, in addition to documentative evidence. It still goes on. So it can't be a dead horse as long as that's going on. And as you and I know, some witnesses just recently in the last year or so have surfaced that we're taking a look at. So.
Right. And we're also, the other side of that coin is that we're running out of time on that, because the guys that were here would now be in their 80s if they're still alive. So
exactly.
The numbers are decreasing, and we have to get after it and stay with it and see if there are any more that come out, hopefully with a deathbed confession or maybe a piece of metal somewhere in somebody's garage or basement or attic or something like that.
You know, ironically, Dennis, and I don't think I've shared this with you yet, I just told Scott Ramsey yesterday, and this just fell out of the sky, but I found an indirect witness to the Aztec crash that is still living.
Good.
Had a phone number and everything, but that person is 95 years old.
Yeah.
And Scott and I were commenting back and forth. I said, that person has been around. I think if we would have known that 10 years ago. You know, obviously she's elderly, and I've got a feeling she's in a rest home. But there's no death record. She's still with us. I don't know if she's cognizant anymore or anything, but the point being is we do come across these witnesses like this from time to time. And, I mean, this one's 95 years old, for God's sakes. So as long as that goes on that way, the work continues, I feel. I don't feel it is beating a dead horse.
No, we can't give up on it, because I think, you know, the four excuses we've had, like I said, if you look at the excuses, you know, first newspaper article we have it in our possession, the next day Ramey covers it up, it's a weather balloon. And then in 94, it was a Mogul balloon to check on the Russians about nuclear testing, which they didn't do until 49, 2 years after the incident. And the one I really like was the last one in 97 with the anthropomorphic crash test on it. 53, they used those. So that's 6 years after the event. Now, if someone's not lying to us, then they're pretty good storytellers, because even the excuses they're given don't hold water.
Yeah. And the little guys in 47 grew into 6 foot tall anthropomorphic dummies
right.
6 years later.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's almost laughable the way, but I really stick with my theory that they just don't know what they have yet, and until they can get their military advantage out of it, I don't think they'll admit to it. They may come up with another excuse, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Hopefully, within our lifetime, we'll figure some of this out. On that note, Dennis, what do you think? What would you like to see? I mean, barring full disclosure, what do you think? Significant.
I don't anticipate full disclosure, because if they would finally admit to this, that's going to open up a whole can of worms, because if the public finds out, then they probably already know that they've been lying to us for 63 years. I mean, look at Iran-Contra, Watergate, Vietnam. I mean, this country is living now on cover-up. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's our Congress and leaders today or whatever. The whole country lives on lying to us. And, you know, the American public, particularly the young people, I at lectures many times, if there's young people there, I tell them, please start asking questions and demand answers. Because to just accept whatever the government tells us is not going to cut it. They've been lying to us for 63 years that we know about. And something has to be done about that. I'm not sure how it can be changed, but it has to change so that we start getting the truth about some of this stuff.
Well, I think in a prime example of that is what Jesse discussed in the first hour, along with what is in his book with Dick D'Amato representing the NSA, and he pulls Jesse down into the deep, dark belly of the Capitol building and says he's investigating the government within the government, wants to know where what black hole this money's going down into, and in essence verifies the Roswell event to Jesse.
Yeah, Jesse told me
just a couple of years ago.
Jesse told me today that he had not ever been threatened, but that he said that they wanted to know what he knew. And I think they're just looking for confirmation on what they already know and see what other people know. You know, a lot of people ask me at lectures, well, aren't you afraid of talking about this? No, because they can deny everything I say.
Right.
I have no proof of anything other than these witnesses, which is word of mouth, really. So, you know, they can deny whatever anybody says. Corso was a good example. Lieutenant Corso, day after Roswell, he said some things in there. He was never threatened because they can deny everything he said.
Sure, yeah. Well, and I think the other part that a mutual friend of ours is shared with both of us is there's a little protection in the light.
Yeah.
It's safer to get out in the public and talk about these things, particularly if you're an individual that's privy to certain information.
Well, yeah, when the interception happened, I talked to Stanton Friedman, and he knew what shape I was in from it, with the paranoia and everything else, and he said, go public. He said, get out there and do it publicly, and he said, if something happens to you, we know to go follow through on it. But he said, you'll feel better, and he was right. The night I did it for the first time, it was like a weight was lifted off of me because I had exposed it. And to me, that was a good feeling to know that I've got them out there now in the public, and if something happens, it happens, and everybody will know why.
Right. And, you know, ironically, of course, that's who I was talking about with Stan. When the last time Stan was out here, I had him explain to my wife there was a time that Stan had a little unnerving situation.
Mm-hmm.
And he took his own medicine and went public. But I always thought that was interesting. I won't go into details here, but one of these times we'll have Stan on and I'll have him explain it. But I had him tell Glenda, I said, explain that to her. She's never heard this side of this stuff.
I like the quote that I use at the end of all my lectures and on my editorials, always telling the truth means never having to remember anything.
Exactly. That's exactly right, and that's good advice in any field or business or life, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dennis, we're as usual. The time just flies by. We've got about 3 minutes left. What's going to go on the rest of this weekend?
Well, we got Karen and Richard Dolan are here, Chuck Tchaikovsky and Debbie Ziegemeier, who were involved in the dig several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We have a guy who is going to talk about June Crane from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that was there at the time that the material was supposedly brought in.
Interesting story.
Dean Merchant is going to talk about when the 509 Bomb Wing, which was involved in Roswell, moved up to Peace Air Force Base, I believe it was, and how the stealth became in existence after they were up there. And he thinks that the Roswell situation had something to do with the B-1 and the stealth F-117 being designed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we have several good lectures still coming up tomorrow, and they'll wrap up the lectures tomorrow, and then Sunday afternoon we'll have a panel discussion for the public with all the speakers there. And Jerry Pippin is there with his radio show and doing live broadcasts from the Civic Center.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking forward to a good weekend.
Mm-hmm. I wish I was there with you.
Yes.
Yeah, it just sounds like fun and a good 4th of July weekend.
I'm going to be master ceremonies at the ESPE convention up in Angel Fire, which is a beautiful part of New Mexico up around Taos and Red River up in the northern part of the state in September.
Mm-hmm.
And got a pretty good lineup of speakers there. And I'll be in Phoenix in October for the MUFON group out there, so I'm looking forward to those.
Is now Stan got the award? He's going to speak tomorrow, I presume.
He probably will have two or three lectures at the museum, I believe. And, you know, like I said earlier, when Stans gets started, you don't stop him. So I'm sure that he'll be entertaining to the people that are there.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll be able to get, Debbie and I would like to get with Kathy, what's her last name? Martin.
Mm-hmm.
She's here with Stanton also, and we're going to try to have them over for breakfast or go to dinner with them one night while they're here, I hope.
He did now. He sent me a copy of his book, Science Was Wrong. I haven't
read
it yet. No, I haven't.
I have.
Yeah,
Harry,
what do you think?
I loved it. There's things in there that you have no idea that took place where the smart people, the scientists and the doctors and things like this, that these couldn't be done, and then a few years later it was accomplished. And it just shows how sometimes the educated aren't as educated as we think they are.
Right. I know Scott and Suzanne Ramsey read it in one or two nights, and in fact,
mm-hmm.
Suzanne, I believe, wrote a quick positive review on it and placed that on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So, and to quote her, it was another home run hit from both he and Kathy. So glad to see that.
I thought that Stanton had written a lot of the medical portions of it, and I was really surprised, being a nuclear physicist, that he knew so much about it, but he informed me that Kathy wrote that.
I think they split the chapters. They did, what, like 7 and 7?
I think so, yeah. And I'm looking forward to Scott and Suzanne's book on Aztec, and I really am.
Oh, we've got some exciting stuff. Now, I've been tasked to write one chapter, and we've got a bevy of new information, if you can believe it, and it is just absolutely fascinating. So
I've been involved with Aztec. I was either a speaker or master ceremonies, but knew Scott and Suzanne for the last 10 or 11 years and worked with them, you know, up there, and have the highest respect for both of them, and I'm really looking forward to the book.
Oh, you're going to love it, yeah. And they're working feverishly on it along with everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that will come out here. Well, probably it'd be safe, I would say, by the end of the year. But it is going to be something, and they really raised the bar with Aztec research in that. But anyway,
great
Dennis,
when you're
out
writing
of time.
Okay.
we've got to close her down. I told Joe that between the two of us, we could probably run till midnight, but we're actually 2 minutes over. I just want to
do it again.
You better believe. And thanks for coming on in such short notice. And give Debbie my best.
I will. Thank you.
And on that note, I'd also like to thank my other special guest, Dr. Jesse Marcel, and, of course, my pal Dennis Balthaser. And I'd like to give a shout-out to Ange for letting me keep her seat warm, and, of course, for you, the listener, for stopping by. I'm Frank Warren for the Joyner Report, coming to you live on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, WPRN New Orleans. And until the next time, good night. Thank you.